Hi, I'm Gala Avery, and welcome to Earwolf Presents, featuring an episode of the Video Archives podcast with Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery. Each week, Earwolf Presents brings you just one episode from the Earwolf universe of podcasts. And today, you'll hear our first episode, where Quentin and Roger discuss Dark Star and Cocaine Cowboys. This episode is an awesome entry point into our podcast, mostly because Quentin and Roger talk about the real history of Video Archives and their relationship. And also, these movies are awesome. If you liked this episode, be sure to subscribe to the Video Archives podcast on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. On this episode of the Video Archives podcast, join Roger and Quentin as they revisit one of Roger's favorite films, the 1974 cult classic Dark Star. Originally created by John Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon as a student film, buckle up for a ride amongst the stars as we follow a group of scientists on a mission to destroy unstable stellar bodies. Listen as Quentin and Roger discuss changing opinions from opening day, break down the film and discuss the impact that it's had on future movies in this genre, and laugh about a beachball alien. Next, we'll return to 1979 with Uli Lamel's cult film Cocaine Cowboys. A rock band is on the brink of superstardom. All that stands in the way is a lost bag of cocaine worth $2 million. Starring Jack Palance, Tom Sullivan, Susanna Love, and Andy Warhol. This film benefits greatly from Quentin and Roger's historical insights as they reveal the truth behind the scenes. Andy Warhol's influences, the Trudeau connection, and how this true story made it onto the big screen. What real history is encoded in this film? Find out now on the Video Archives podcast. Here's Quentin and Roger.
You're listening to the Video Archives podcast, starring former employee of Video Archives, Quentin Tarantino, with my co-host, co-colleague behind the counter of Video Archives, co-writer of the Oscar-winning Pulp Fiction, and in this current endeavor, Sancho Panza to my windmill-tilting Don Quixote, Roger Roberts Avery.
That's me. And yeah, I was thinking about Video Archives today, and obviously because we're in this podcast, and I, you know, as I was driving in and I was thinking about like when it started and how it started.
Which started in Manhattan Beach, California on 11822 North Sepulveda Boulevard.
Yeah. Archives began because when I was a kid, our friend, Scott McGill, his dad had a store called Video Outtakes. Like the original title, I think, was Video Takeout, but then there was another Video Takeout somewhere, something. And so
they just reversed it.
And this is like 1978, 1979.
So this is like when the very first of the commercial videos started being released.
This is in the days when we still rented beta tapes. Like, for instance, Disney, Buena Vista. Mm-hmm. You could not buy their tapes to rent. You had to rent the tapes from Buena Vista and then, you know, rent them out to customers. The store never owned the tape. And so they were still discovering what the model for home video was.
Most of them were like iLot Artist home videos and Magnetic home videos.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there was a partnership at that store. It was between Dean, who was Scott's dad, and this guy, Lance Lawson. Mm-hmm. And who was kind of the videophile who owned all the cool titles at Outtakes. I worked at the store for a number of years, and that's when you started walking in.
Yeah.
And you had been perusing other stores in the area, and you landed there.
Well, I had a whole thing back then where it was wherever I was at, it didn't matter. I mean, any town, any city that I was at, if I was driving around or just walking around or something, if I saw a mom and pop video store, or actually if I saw any video store, I would just go in. I would just go in to see what they had because I was always wanted to know what was available out there and what I could possibly get. I would spend 2 hours in the store seeing everything they had, but then, like, you know, you'd find two or three videos that nobody else had. And so I always did that. And there was some reason why I was in Redondo Beach without a car. Yeah, I was just walking down PCH and then, oh, okay, here's another store, like mom and pop store I've never been in before. Let's just see. And I'm just used to the mom and pops knowing fuck all about movies.
Yeah. Right?
You know, this was an investment for them. So I walked in the store and lo and behold, there's Lance Lawson, who's at that time in my life, knew more about movies than any living person I had ever met. I was always the only person who knew that much about movies. But Lance was like this mentor, hippie guy in the...
The beatnik almost.
Yeah, hippie guy from the in the early 80s. And so I would like come by and they had all this stuff that nobody else had. and I would go and shoot the shit with him.
He would do things for us, like he would get us Filmex tickets. Mm-hmm. He would take us to Douglas Trumbull's show scan when it was first invented. He would do all sorts of great things for like our little community of guys.
Well, the thing is, Lance was always doing stuff like that. I remember he knew I was really into rockabilly, and that was when the Everly Brothers got back together again. And he took me to the Greek Theater to see the Everly Brothers. I couldn't have afforded those tickets normally, nor would it even ever occur to me to try to get tickets to the Greek Theater to go see the Everly Brothers. He took me down in the Amundsen to see Nicholas Nickleby when it came to Los Angeles, that whatever that was, that five-hour version of Nicholas Nickleby. He introduced us to things and events more sophisticated than the things that we normally gravitated towards. My whole introduction to Video Outtakes and Lance was just, you know, randomly stopping into Video Outtakes, meeting Lance, and like having a two-hour conversation with him. And whenever I found myself in Redondo Beach, stopping by and, you know, talking to him again. Then about a year and a half later or something, I dropped by and I never saw Lance there.
Yeah.
It was usually Dean. But then there was this young kid there, Scott McGill, mm-hmm. mutual friend of ours. I met him. He was the son of the owner. And then so I started having nice conversations with him. And then at one point, he was, you know, I was about 22 and he was about 17. And so one day I come in there and I'm talking to Scott and I go, hey, whatever happened to that Lance guy? I kept coming by and, you know, I guess he doesn't work. And they go, oh, no, he started his own store. He did? Yeah. It's just down the street on Sepulveda Boulevard in Manhattan Beach, Video Archives. So that's how I knew about Video Archives.
And so Lance started Video Archives and I went with him as sort of a new, fresh kind of experience. I wrote the computer software for the mm-hmm. inventory system on an mm-hmm. Atari 800 mm-hmm. computer using floppy disks. You probably remember actually operating that thing and constantly having to swap out like floppy disks. And
we didn't have a cash register for 4 years.
Yeah. It was a really like mom and pop, mm-hmm. you know, place where we were given complete title and license to run the place.
Even though it had the brick and mortar and the business model of a mom and pop video store, it was closer to an underground newspaper.
Totally.
That we were doing. Not a fanzine, an official newspaper that required print, that required us to get our shit together, to pay bills and do all that stuff. And the guys it was a bunch of video cassettes that the people of Manhattan Beach could come in there and rent. But it was the environment that we offered and the people that the store attracted and the people in Manhattan Beach that it attracted. And it wasn't just like, oh, the only people that came there were film geeks like us. No, that's actually absolutely not the case. 80% of the people were just regular, well-to-do
families.
Well-to-do families that lived in the neighborhood. So they weren't like us, but they liked that the people running the video store were like us. They were like, "Hey, let's go down with the crazy movie guys."
Yeah,
and you know, and then let's ask them what they suggest. And we became a topic of conversation all over Manhattan Beach because we had this cool store. Just like the way, and you know, actually, what it was really like. What it was exactly like is like the real cool used record store in town.
Yeah.
Except it was a video store with all the, you know, with all the music heads and the wannabe musicians and archivists, you know, that work there.
And
know the entire collection. The premise of this show, one of the things that me and Roger did working at the video store is along with putting shelves, renting out, setting up new customers, which was always the biggest pain in the ass, renting out video cassettes, and putting stuff back up on shelves and recommending films to people was we talked about movies all day. We watched movies all day. We talked about movies all day. Customers came in just to talk with us. We debated and argued about films all day. We saw everything that was out there. And it was just this place where we could talk about movies and basically not have to work for a living. My idea is to recreate that. And this podcast. Now, the thing is, when Video Archives went out of business, I bought the collection. So I have all the video cassettes from Video Archives, and we're sitting in a room that
looks almost like an obsessive shrine to video archives, but it's simply a place for me to put the videos.
Yeah, it's like a mausoleum would be
it's
more
just
that.
It's just a really groovy storeroom, all right? It's not this fetishistic object that it probably appears.
Yeah, well, understand, even to me, who spent like years and years, like a decade more of my life, like handling all of these tapes every single day, you know, putting them in and out of the system and like touching them every day and then not seeing them for, you know, 25 years, the majority of my life. Yeah, okay. And then coming back and the shelves are still the same.
Yeah, it's the same shelves. Because, and, well, because they fit. All right.
And I come back in and lo and behold, it's the store. It's the store. Now, I purchased all the laser discs.
Yeah, you have the laser discs.
Back then, so I...
But you keep reminding us.
Well... It's Avery's folly. It was maybe a fool's errand. I couldn't afford the whole
My video
store.
Cassettes are hanging in there far better than your laser discs. I just want
to
say.
Yeah, my laser discs have succumbed mostly to laser rot. At least a good 25-30% of the collection, the glue that holds the platens together, the two platters, because laser discs have two sides. You actually, it's like a DVD that you have to flip. Mm-hmm. And the glue tends to erode the optical.
Over the course of decades.
Yeah. Sometimes over the course of months, was the case. And so I have many, many discs where I can only play half of it.
Well, the thing is for the episode is I have all the video archives videos. And then when another magnificent video store in LA County called Eddie Brandt's, when they went out of business, I got their inventory.
Yeah, they were great.
So the format of the show that we'll be dealing with from episode to episode, we're going to do a little different on tonight's episode. We're just going to go with two films. But normally, the way it's going to work is we're going to pick three movies from the Video Archives collection that I pull from the shelves that we're going to discuss. The idea usually is the first two movies sort of work to some degree as a double feature. They can be completely opposite to each other, but they kind of work as a, if any of the films will be known, more known, it'll be the first two. Mm-hmm. But then the idea for the third one is like that third film that plays at a drive-in triple feature, a very, very obscure video cassette, usually exploitation-y or very obscure in like in a foreign sense, or just in any, just obscurity, all right? Not the kind of movies that when you found them at a video store, you had no fucking idea what this is. Okay, maybe Jack Palance is in it. That's interesting. Maybe Stuart Whitman is in it. Okay, that's interesting. Carol Baker's in it. Okay, maybe that's interesting. Okay, I don't know what the fuck Demonoid is. I'm going to give it a shot. Yeah. And you take it home and you have this big surprise. And that was actually part of the joy of going to a video store and selecting those three tapes. And there was always that one weird one. Okay, I'll throw that one in too. And those were some of the discoveries that you remembered from the 80s. So that's our idea for a format for the show.
But the point is here, we're watching the video cassettes from the collection. It's not, we're now watching the Blu-rays. We're not watching some weird director's cut. We're not watching.
It's not on YouTube.
No, it's just, you know, if we don't have the video cassette, they can't be counted as a movie.
Yeah.
It has to be from the collection.
It has to be in our inventory.
And also, because we're all about the home video, physical media, rah-rah everything
the fetishism of tactile objects.
Of that is, you know, it is about, along with the movie, it's about the video, it's about the transfer, was it in the SP mode, was it in the EP mode,
was
it
the video distributor?
SLP mode. If a film is from Paragon Home Video, we will go off for a while talking about the glories of Paragon Home Video. And then we'll get around to the title that we're talking about. Okay, so with no further ado, Roger, why don't you start it off?
We're going to start off with really one of my favorite movies, absolutely one of my favorite comedies, absolutely one of my favorite science fiction films, absolutely one of my favorite cult films, which actually was pulled out of the cult section of archives. I actually, at first, had trouble finding
it. It was in the science fiction section.
No, actually, it was in the cult section, at least in the inventory. It was held in the cult section. Uh-huh. That's why I had trouble finding it. I was like looking it up in my thing. I was like, it's not in the comedy. Oh my God, it's not in the science fiction.
I think in my day, we more...
It should have been in
the science
fiction.
Yeah. I mean, it's rents more when it was in the science fiction. If you had two copies, you would put one in the cult.
Yeah, exactly. It's John Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon's magnificent science fiction comedy, Dark Star.
Brought to you by?
Brought to you by United Home Video. In one of the most beautiful, like kind of the plastic boxes that really protected the tape.
It's large size clamshell.
No paper, you know, good like vinyl with a plastic sheeting around.
It's, and actually the most witty of all the covers I've seen of it, the wittiest cover. Yeah,
it's a later cover because they early on they had trouble selling the movie. People thought it was a serious film. And so this is the comedy cover.
Yeah, the floating toilet paper in space gives you a clue.
And I will now give a plot synopsis of the film by reading the back of the United Home Video video box.
Always the best way to get a glean on the film.
Right on. In the mid-21st century, mankind has reached a point in its technological advances to enable colonization of the far reaches of the universe. Darkstar is a futuristic scout ship traveling far in advance of colony ships, armed with exponential thermostellar bombs. It prowls the unstable planets. One obstacle that its crew members did not count on. One of the ship's thinking and talking bombs is lodged in the bay, threatening to destroy the entire ship and crew. Exclamation. John Halloween Carpenter and Dan Alien O'Bannon combine their writing, creative, and technical talents to bring you this thrilling and extraordinary science fiction parody. That's the only parody. The word parody is the only clue that the film is a comedy.
Yeah.
91 minutes, 1971, color, and the tape number in the science fiction section is 199.
That is an early, early tape.
Darkstar started off as a student film that was being done at USC, directed by John Carpenter, and pretty much done in collaboration with a fellow student, Dan O'Bannon, who wrote the script with Carpenter, was the production designer, did all the special effects, edited the movie, and is the lead of the film.
Yeah.
So it truly, I mean, in every way, shape, and form, it can be called a Carpenter-Dan O'Bannon film. It is a complete joint effort of these two men together. The only time they will ever work together, and it's understandable, but also sad at the same time, because it was a magnificent collaboration. Roger, talk to us about Darkstar.
I saw this movie in 1974 on its initial release. Uh-huh. So when it came out in theaters, I was in Palo Alto at the time, and it played, probably for the Stanford. I wasn't a Stanford student. My family was living in the Menlo Park
area. How old were you then? Like 12?
Yeah, it was like nine, I think. Yeah. I was like 9 years old. Yeah, and it was rated G, and it's a science fiction movie. Yeah. And so I went and saw it, and my cousins went and took me to see it, and I had like a bunch of hippie cousins. And so I immediately, I think because of them, understood the movie, because they were totally dialed into counterculture. This movie is perfectly aligned with what would become sort of how I view my sense of humor and my perspective on the world. And I've since learned it's Dan O'Bannon.
Yeah.
That is, you know, I mean, listen, this movie is, it's very well directed, but it's, I mean, Dan O'Bannon is such a personality in this movie because he's actually a physical presence within the film. And there's so much charm associated to his perspective of the universe, which is
anti-charm,
which is like Dan O'Bannon was one of the very first guys who kind of figured out this concept of a used universe where there was like truckers and oil derrick workers and miners and stuff like that in space.
Yeah, a lower class, working class, all right, inside of space travel.
Yeah. And then
not everybody like the Enterprise.
And to me, this was like a massively successful comedy release. Like I was laughing when I saw it. Everybody around me was laughing. Years later, I kind of heard, and actually from O'Bannon, that people didn't get the movie the way I did, or the way people went expecting, I think based on the poster, more 2001. It was around 1989 or so when I was in college that I went hardcore on Darkstar. And I started watching it like all the time.
Oh, great.
And I started frankly, like just studying Dan O'Bannon's kind of humor, his kind of whack version of, I mean, he's called it Waiting for Godot. I did Waiting for Godot when I was in theater in high school. And I don't think of Waiting for Godot as anything like Darkstar. Waiting for Godot is completely abstract. To me, Darkstar is like not abstract at all. It's comedy.
Well, I mean, it's like, I mean, one of the things that was interesting, and I'll talk about when I talk about the film, watching it with you, I saw it once when it came out and I hadn't seen it since. So it was funny watching it with you, because I remember even from like from being a little kid, I remember different elements of it. But I was really kind of seeing it for the first time, with the exception of these moments.
When we
watched it together. Yeah, when we watched it together.
Yeah.
But I could tell you had seen it like 10 times. All right. You're responding to it like
I'm anticipating the laughs that I'm about to make.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, you were watching the way we would watch Evil Dead 2 with somebody who's never seen Evil Dead 2 before. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. I mean, part of what I love about Dark Star is, one, that it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. I really like the imperfections in cinema. I like to see the handmade quality of things. Mm-hmm. And Dark Star is so handmade that it almost looks like a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. To the extent that I think some people might look at it and think it just looks like kind of cheap, bad effects. But to me,
I don't think that.
I don't think that at all. Mm-hmm. Also, as I started becoming a filmmaker, mm-hmm. and which was around the same time like that we're talking about, the 89, I mean, it was long before then. I was making Super 8 movies, mm-hmm. and we were doing all sorts of stuff together, mm-hmm. and writing and everything in those early days at Video Archives. But when I seriously started trying to approach being a filmmaker, I really kind of looked to a lot of these handmade movies that, you know, that I admired so deeply. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there's a number of them that I can point at.
Yeah, but Dark Star really is a shining jewel amongst that.
It is so much so because it was a student film, mm-hmm. because it existed as one thing and they expanded it. And, you know, the Scorsese film is like the only other one that I can think of offhand.
Oh, yeah.
That it was like a... Who's that knocking at my door? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a student film.
But to some degree, you could say the same thing about Greetings, same thing about High Mom.
Well, and frankly, we could say the same thing about Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
If we were to go there, that one of the things about Reservoir Dogs is we were talking about making that originally as a very handmade kind of film. Like motorcycle garage that a friend owned.
Probably a muffler shop is where
it was. Like a muffler shop. Yeah, it was that muffler shop. Because
but it's not though, because we actually got a budget and we
you did it for real.
We had trucks and shit like that, which we never would have had if we were piecing it together on weekends.
I think the point is though that you were going to make that movie no matter what.
Oh, that's for sure.
No matter what, that movie was going to get made. You know, like I look at movies in as two kind of things. I look at them as plot and story. Mm-hmm. And plot, people will go to see a movie once mm-hmm. for the plot. It's just the basic events that occur that move everything along. Story is everything that that isn't the plot, that you hang on the plot. Mm-hmm. It's the lighting. It's the theme. It's the, you know, the layers of the onion that are even mm-hmm. unspoken. You know, it's all sorts of other elements. The screenplay, you can tell it's written by people who want... First of all, they saw 2001 mm-hmm. and they just went crazy. They were kids when they saw 2001 mm-hmm. or teens when they saw mm-hmm. 2001 and were like, and it made an impression on it. And 2001 is about technology that's breaking.
Also, at the same time, I think this seems to be an answer to 2001, an anti-2001.
It's 2001 made as Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
You know, it's a kind of systems failing. And Kubrick, all of his movies are about systems failing.
I think
fail.
There's also a criticism of 2001. A criticism of the suits, a criticism of the 60s, of middle age, middle classness, a criticism of the antiseptic quality of the lack of humanity that is supposedly all part of space travel in movies. This is bringing life and piss and shit and cum into the space world. Literally, in the case of the toilet paper, which is an issue in the movie.
And it's witty. It's incredibly witty. It's making the same, like there's one joke supposedly in 2001, which is the zero gravity toilet.
Yeah.
And he's like reading the instructions for it. Like one of the final images in this is the zero gravity toilet floating by.
It survived the
explosion. So this pinback character that's played by Dan O'Bannon, he's actually this guy, Bill Frug, who scored apparently like a 74 or something. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to get like 700 to be an astronaut. Yeah. He scored 74. He's just a maintenance worker.
Yeah, he's like the loading dock, right?
He's literally the loading dock.
I've completely forgot about this aspect when I watched the movie again. Where I went, what, pinback isn't pinback?
Yeah, he's not even pinback. None of them really care about this, but what's interesting about that is he seems to be the one who cares the most about everything. Like, and I just love Dan O'Bannon's voice. So like when he says something like, you know, that's related to the heating manifold.
Yeah. Right.
That's dangerous. You know, he just has such a, he's concerned about things because he knows the workings of the ship.
Well, in a strange way, everybody else has just gotten disillusioned.
Yeah.
Or spaced out, like the guy who's just basically taking bong hits, all right, in the...
Well, they're actually at various levels of space out from the from the captain who's like, hello? Like he's in a stasis.
Well, he's dead.
He's in a, but he's in a kind of weird state. It's like, why don't you visit me more often?
Yeah, but he's dead. Yeah. It's but not spaced out. He's dead.
Well, that's a kind of spaced. That's the ultimate spaced out.
But in a weird way, it's like Pinback is the one who is like grown into his character. He's grown into his responsibilities while everyone else is forgetting theirs.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they, when it finally came time for them to make the movie. And when they got some extra money, and I don't know how much they made the student film for versus how much money they were getting.
I think since they paid for the movie themselves, I'm sure it wasn't more than $6,000 or something like that. But it's always just mentioned the entire budget, which was $40,000.
Yeah.
Which is just mind-blowing.
Yeah, it really is hard to wrap your head around. But at the same time, when everything's handmade, you're also, you're getting super talented people for nothing. You're getting Ron Cobb.
Yeah.
Who, at the time, I just knew him as a cartoonist.
Well, he was. He was just a cartoonist for the LA Free Press.
Yeah, yeah. He was like one
He'll later go on to be the production designer on Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah, and designed all the ships for Alien. I've seen the sketches that Ron Cobb did of Dark Star, and they're so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like, they are so professional.
But Dan O'Bannon did the special effects.
Yeah.
He is the one responsible for the special effects. He marshaled all those talents.
Oh, for sure.
This is his movie when it comes to special effects.
I didn't respect or know Dan O'Bannon well enough. I didn't know his contribution.
Yeah.
Not enough of it was available. There was no internet.
There was a name I knew. I was not a huge fan of Dan O'Bannon. I always liked everybody else he collaborated with more than him.
You know, and frankly, when he did Return of the Living Dead, I was such a George Romero fan that it became very easy for me to marginalize him a little bit.
Yeah.
And
how dare you make the next Night of the Living Dead sequel the same year that George Romero is doing his sacrilege.
Now, with the benefit of time and perspective and also information, like having access to it and being able to read about Dan O'Bannon and being able to read what happened to him. And I talked to Jodorowsky about him, everything I've learned about him. I feel so bad forever, ever maligning him in my mind or not even maligning him, just like soft pedaling him.
I feel the same, I identify
with him now.
Like I feel the same way you do, except I didn't come to it till this week.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed not liking him, and I've enjoyed slagging him off. And now I feel guilty.
Well, when we popped it in and watched it together, now I hadn't seen Dark Star maybe for a couple of years at least. And then we watched it together. Mm-hmm. And you know, like whenever you watch a movie with somebody else, you're seeing it through their eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think we had seen it. Like I may have popped this in at the store, because I can guarantee the week that this came out, I was pushing it. And if it was in the store, I was playing it.
Yeah.
I'm sure of it. Mm-hmm. And
I'm sure if you put it on when I was in, like, oh God, Dark Star.
Yeah. Do you have to?
Okay. Whatever.
But anyhow, I treasure the film now. Mm-hmm. I look at Dan O'Bannon and I understand his contribution and I appreciate it because I identify with it. I identify with that. Hey, let's make this movie. Let's do whatever we can to make the impossible possible.
I think my first exposure to Dark Star was through Starlog magazine, and reading it there, seeing all the kind of handmade production art and everything by Ron Cobb and what these guys were doing, and that this was a student film.
Well, and also, you know, when Carpenter does Halloween, you know, he's going to be written about in every genre magazine in the world, and they're all going to have a section at the beginning of the piece that goes through the history of Dark Star and then goes on to Assault on Precinct 13 before it gets to Halloween.
Now, let me ask you, when they were talking about Dark Star, immediately following Halloween, was it sort of like, oh, this is his Fear and Desire, or maybe
Killer's
Kiss?
No,
or was this like Dark Star?
Yeah, it was considered an absolute cult film classic, but, you know, by 78.
Yeah, for sure.
It's absolutely a cult film classic. He's the one talking it down more than anything else. You know, he even said recently to the effect, well, I don't really respond to it because I see its student film origins. I see very little student film origins. To me, it just looks like a good science fiction movie. I know some of the effects have been done cheaply. I wouldn't know that from just necessarily watching it. I don't think, hey, look, I see cleverness going on.
You would spend a lot of money to try to get that look now.
Yeah, I see cleverness up the wazoo, but I don't think, oh, look, isn't this charm? It's full of charm. It exists on charm. That's all it is charm. But there's also craftsmanship there. I don't see, oh, look at these cool kids that did this really neat thing with the little bit they had. Especially when I was a kid and I saw it, I didn't like it, and I'll go into that in a second. But it looked like a real science fiction movie. I had no question about the look of it, the special effects, the spaceship sets. I mean, everything was, I mean, I could watch it today having made movies, and I would not know it was made for $40,000. I never would have guessed. I would not know anything about the student film origin of it. I would not, it's just a fucking legitimate piece of work in every way, shape, or form.
Well, I'm going to presume that what Carpenter is talking about is that when you make a movie, it becomes the experience of making the film.
Yeah.
And you end up associating all the good or bad that nobody else ever knows or sees. Mm-hmm. And if you've, you know, had a rough experience on something or been screwed over by a producer or whatever has occurred or
look, well, he looks at it and goes, okay, those are ice trays. Those are ice cube trays that I'm shining light through. So he can only see the ice cube trays.
Yeah.
He can only see the muffin tins.
I love the ice cube trays.
Me too.
To me too. The ice cube trays show innovation and resourcefulness that I didn't really see again in a science fiction movie until I think it was it Battle Beyond the Stars?
Yeah.
Where they were really like...
Yeah. Well, when James Cameron is like going and buying the styrofoam, a quarter pounder with cheese and Big Mac.
Just to have the styrofoam containers.
The styrofoam containers and like, you know, putting them all over the walls.
Yeah.
And painting them and putting them all over the walls.
Yeah, it was super innovation.
Okay, so now I'm going to tell you my history with Dark Star, where I saw it in 74 when it came out. I saw it in Marina del Rey, UA. I hated it in 74. When I saw it. So you were 9, I was probably 11. Mm-hmm. I hated it. And I'll tell you why I hated it is because I knew fuck all about it other than the TV spots that Jack Harris had blanketed afternoon television with. So I saw the TV spots a bunch of times and looked like a really groovy space movie to me. I go, wow, I can't wait to see this. And so that weekend came about and I went and saw it. Okay, so this is... To say the least, this is before Star Wars. Okay, so what did I want? Well, I will say that I do think the TV spots were misleading. Okay, the TV spots...
ad campaign was misleading.
Yeah, makes you think that it's like a Star Trek-y Buck Rogers kind of thing. Not all the dare doing, but it just looks like a real space movie. So like... For instance,
they show the plasma rifle going off. Like all the moments that you could sell to make it look like
and
that.
And they don't show you any, they don't give you a hint of the counterculture aspect of it. And they don't give you the gonzo anti-establishment quality of it. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking it's just a straight ahead science fiction movie. And I have, if the movie they had played had been Luigi Cozzi's Star Crash.
Yeah.
I would have thought, okay, this is it, man. Oh, this is exactly what I wanted to see. If I had seen Star Crash when I went and saw Dark Star, I would have been completely satisfied. Yeah. That would have been exactly what I wanted. That would have been exactly what the TV spot asked for. That's what I wanted to see Star Crash way before it was ever made when I went and see Dark Star. So what I ended up seeing, I fucking hated. And it was very funny watching the movie now with a completely different point of view, because I've always said, oh, I hate Dark Star.
Become fashionable to say it.
And it was interesting watching it now, remembering how much I hated it, because everything that I love about the movie now is what irritated the shit out of me at 11. I hated the idea that the crew were these dirty fucking hippie guys. All right. By 74, a little boy, I was so over the fucking hippie thing. All right. I was so over my babysitter's boyfriends. All right. I was so over seeing those people, the older sons of my mom's friends. I was so over that whole thing.
My cousins, Jeff and David, were those guys.
Yeah.
So I got taken to the movie by those guys.
Okay. Yeah. And not only that, this was the first time I had seen by this point in time I had seen bad actors before. This was the first time I went to a movie and bought a ticket where, oh, I'm sitting here watching the movie thinking, oh, these guys aren't bad actors. They're not even actors. These are amateur actors. Everything about them just seemed unprofessional. Everything about them seemed unlike actors.
And they're playing people you hate.
Yeah. The counterculture stuff just bummed me out. Mm-hmm. Like when they went to, like, one of the biggest laughs is when they go to their barracks. Mm-hmm. And it's all like the porno magazines on the wall and all the hippie kind of thing. I'm like, oh God, it's like I repelled from all the anti-establishment aspect of it. I repelled about the fact that they look like hippies. I did not like the captain. I thought, oh, no way is this guy the captain of the ship. When the beach ball alien shows up, okay, being 11. Okay, also, I'm 11. So it's right at that time you start getting intolerant about stuff. Oh, it's so stupid. Oh God, jeez. Oh, that's so stupid. Oh, so dumb. It's so stupid. It's so stupid. And everything, you know, the surfing at the end out of the blue. Oh, it's so stupid. This is so stupid. All right. Everything I thought was just so dumb. I will admit that as time went on, I started responding to Pinback to some degree. But you have to understand, I'm watching the movie. I'm the only little boy there. Everybody else is like could be in the fucking movie, all right? They're all like hippie kind of anti-establishment, you know, teenagers or guys in their 20s watching the movie. They all get it. They all get it, and they all love it. And they're loving everything I hate. And they're fucking annoying me. I mean, I'm just getting madder and madder and madder. Because back when I was a little boy and I paid to see a movie and I felt I got hoodwinked, I was mad. And I'm sitting there mad watching the movie. And the fact that they were appreciating everything that made me mad at them. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there with my arms crossed and just fucking this is a fucking ripoff, man. Popcorn was the best thing about this fucking movie. I haven't seen it since then. We watched it with you the other day. I'm practically trepidatious about saying how I feel about the movie now for the simple fact that the thing that I don't want to do on this podcast is throw around the M word. I want the M word to mean something. The M word is masterpiece. I want the M word to mean something. I don't want to throw it around. And I don't want to use the M word on the very first movie we talk about, but I actually think it applies to Dark Star. It's a science fiction masterpiece. It's a counterculture, anti-establishment, hippie filmmaking masterpiece. It's an early 70s masterpiece. I still agree that the guy playing Boiler is miscast. He looks like some buddy of theirs.
He looks like a biker or something.
Yeah, he looks like some hippie buddy of theirs that they enlisted to do the movie. And the guy in the
he was like an accounting student or something. Yeah. He was the one guy outside of their group.
Yeah, well, you can tell. Yeah. You can tell. And the guy in the dome doesn't really make much of an impression. And in the first half of the movie, I don't really care for the Captain Doolittle any more than I did back when I was younger. But he gets better as the movie goes on. In the course of time, he actually does grow as the film goes on. And in his final, you know, the climax of the movie, his philosophical conversation with Bomb 20, mm-hmm. He's fantastic.
He's amazing.
I mean, he's great in that scene. He's great in that scene. He builds up until that moment. And I can't really imagine that scene being done necessarily better. He is pretty terrific in that scene. But the thing that carries the entire movie through is Dan O'Bannon's comedy performance that I did not appreciate when I was younger and I have not appreciated up until now. And it rivals Bruce Campbell's comedy performance in
it's a good comparison.
The Evil Dead movies. Well, they almost seem like there's a symbiotic relationship between the two of them. And the big set piece in the movie, which was added much later, it's part of the thing that they added for Jack H. Harris to make it feature length, is the entire, what seems like a 15-minute set piece, mm-hmm. With Dan O'Bannon fighting with this alien beach ball monster that they brought on the ship. Now, the thing about the movie is the entire, all the special effects in the film is them literally trying to do the best that they possibly can to make it look like a real movie and make it look like a real spaceship and make it look like real space travel. And by the way, they completely predate the jump to light speed.
Oh, completely.
In Star Wars. I mean, yeah. To such a degree, it's obvious George Lucas saw this and used the idea for the light speed travel.
They're doing a kind of proto slit scan yeah. photography.
I mean, it's impossible that Lucas had not seen that.
Yeah.
I mean, we know he saw it.
I even think it's better because it mm-hmm. feels more like what I imagine real light speed would be like.
Yeah.
Like I love that they go into a kind of stasis, like, and there's a sort of highly graphic quality to that moment. Mm-hmm. I love that there's this kind of streaked sparks flying by. And then most especially when they come out of light speed.
It just stops.
It just comes dropping out as if, like, and that it had a feeling to it.
Yeah.
There's so many feelings to the way the movie is made. That feeling of coming out of light speed, mm-hmm. I think is way better than any other light speed I've ever seen other movie. That feeling of coming out of it is sublime. It's a sublime moment.
It's amazing.
The moment when mm-hmm. the kind of lightning bolt during the meteor shower, the lightning bolt strikes the mm-hmm. access bay and the camera kind of zooms in on the flash. And then you see this kind of highly graphic, almost, I mean, it looks like a graphic novel. It looks mm-hmm. like, you know, painted by Mobius or something. Mm-hmm, yeah. It's like it's like an animation.
Yeah.
It has such a tactile, handmade feeling. Like they really knew exactly what they were going for. They knew the comic beats that they were going for. Mm-hmm. Dan O'Bannon, I was convinced my whole life that he was the voice of the bomb. I've since heard he wasn't the voice mm-hmm, of the bomb.
Yeah. One of the first huge laughs that I had in Dark Star watching it again is when they're dropping Bomb 19 and the conversation that Pinback has with Bomb 19 is Bomb 19 goes off to blow up the planet. Bomb 19, okay, bye!
Yeah, bye!
So after pulling off all this convincing special effects, they have this alien and they purposely make it cheesy. They purposely make it crazy. They take a red beach ball and put a Creature of the Black Lagoon feed on it.
Yeah.
And again, like I said, when I was a kid, I despised that sequence. But here, I think it's one of the great comedy set pieces of that time period. And I think ranks up, is right there with Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell with the Attack of the Helping Hand, or the possessed hand sequence from Evil Dead 2. And not only that, though, even now acknowledging, oh, well, they're having fun with the fact that it's a red beach ball. Nick Castle is the puppeteer.
Yeah.
He's operating the beach ball alien monster who later would play the shape in the first Halloween film. And Nick Castle does a tremendous job making that beach ball come to life.
Yeah.
It actually, he gives it a personality.
It's a Muppet-like performance.
Yeah.
Just using his hands.
He gives it a sense of humor. He mm-hmm. he gives it a sense of mischievousness. He gives it a sense of malevolence.
It kind of just wants to play. Like, I have a cat like that just wants to, like, you know, come get me and claw me in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And he just wants to play. And I love how when Dan O'Bannon goes in, they have some like a lighting effect that's meant to be some other.
He's
like, get out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Those weird twinkly.
He's just annoyed with them at this
point. Just annoyed with everything. And so there's an entire sequence that is just absolute comedy gold that takes place where Dan O'Bannon is stuck in a elevator shaft fighting the alien. And at the end of the day, along with the theme of whatever, it's one of the reasons why people talk about Dark Star to this day. It's this big sequence.
And it has like a little nod there in that moment mm-hmm. to 2001 with the explosive bolts in the elevator and like prepare for the explosive bolts going off.
Yeah. What's funny is we're watching, I'm buying the whole elevator shaft. I'm not going to relate how it was filmed. You have to figure that out yourself. But as I'm watching it, I'm buying the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
And then at some point you go, wow, see, he's doing a really good job selling the effect. And when you said that, that made me figure out how they did it.
Yeah, sorry.
But up until, which made me just say appreciate it even more. But up until that time, I bought it. I was just there.
Kind of like Harold Lloyd.
Yeah. He's absolutely doing a Harold Lloyd.
Amazing comic physical performance. I mean, Bruce Campbell is a great comparison.
So look, that is my take on Dark Star. I actually think it's a classic now. I've revisited it, and I could not be more in love with it. In fact, of all the films that we saw, it's the one that I keep going back to. It's the one that kind of haunted me a little bit. I keep finding myself thinking whether it's that Benson, Arizona theme song or it's
very melancholic film,
O'Banion's moment.
Like when the lights turn on in the elevator shaft and when the bolts go off in the elevator, or at least when they are armed in the elevator, when they go off, to be honest, that scene doesn't end.
My biggest criticism of the whole film is to commit to such a long comic set piece as they do. I'm totally down with, but now you need to end it the right way. Yeah. And they just kind of wrap it up. You don't buy how he got out of it. After stretching it out and making it amazing, you don't buy how they got out of it.
Yeah, and I feel only then do I feel that the scene was inserted into something.
Right.
Like that it didn't really have a satisfying kind of.
Yeah, he got himself into all this trouble. He had to get out of it in a way that you buy.
Yeah.
And they just kind of wrap it up. Now, the thing is, I've got a couple quotes. I've gone through my literature and stuff. Carpenter gave a quote about Dark Star, but after making the movie and releasing it, I thought that once it was out, meaning Dark Star, the film industry would come rushing at my door and carry me off on their shoulders to another film. So I was somewhat shocked and depressed that no one paid attention.
Yeah, I've been there.
No one really cared. No one considered it a legitimate film. It may seem like a successful cult movie now, but for me, it was a 4-year struggle.
Yeah. It's hard to separate yourself from that, the pain of that.
In a similar vein, in issue 20 of Fangoria from 1982, there's a roundtable discussion between Landis, Cronenberg, and Carpenter by Mick Garris. And they're starting it off. And Mick goes, can you describe your experience from the transition from film school to becoming an actual director? Carpenter kind of repeats his spiel about Dark Star. It's difficult. I made a film with my own money, about $60,000, and I fought my way with it. And once it was released, I thought all the studio heads were going to come over to my house in limousines, knock on the door and say, we've seen your film. We know you're great. Come on. There's a crew waiting on the street.
Yeah. We all think that to some extent. Yeah.
But they didn't care. All right. So now, if you look it up in the Psychotronic, Michael Weldon Psychotronic Film Guide, the Dark Star entry is an impressive accomplishment that started as a USC project shot in 16mm and running around 45 minutes. Jack H. Harris put up additional funds, so the original footage was blown up to 35 and 43 minutes were added. The whole thing cost about $60,000. It received a limited theatrical release in 1975 and has since become a midnight and college favorite. Young spacemen fight boredom while on a protracted mission to destroy unstable suns. Planets, actually. Except for a purposely laughable beach ball alien, the special effects are excellent. Co-script writer Dan O'Bannon also stars as Pinback. He later wrote Alien, a somewhat similar film, but without Dark Star's comedy. Carpenter went on to demonstrate his directorial skill on Assault on Precinct 13 and Halloween. A soundtrack is available. And then in the LA Reader, Myron Mazel wrote about Dark Star, a witty and stylish science fiction satire by John Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween Carpenter, and Dan Alien O'Bannon. The Dark Star is an intergalactic bomber wandering through the universe on a vaguely Nixonian mission. Actually, I like the description of a Nixonian future. On a vaguely Nixonian mission to destroy unpopulated planets that might stand in the way of space travel. The ship's crew is variously bored, blissed out, and relentlessly rambunctious. By introducing human eccentricities, mostly of a Southern California ilk, into the cult structure of sci-fi, Carpenter creates a vision of the technological future that is both disillusioned and oddly affirmative in its insistence on the unscientific survival of emotional frailty. Amazingly, the film was made on a reported budget of $60,000.
Do you think, we know that Dan O'Bannon is Pinback. And I think the hint of this is the bottle music machine. Do you think Doolittle is meant to be representative of Carpenter?
Well, I would
think that's who Carpenter would place himself within the movie.
Well, I would have thought. Well, no, I don't see him. I mean, I don't see Carpenter being as disillusioned as Doolittle is. He doesn't care about anything. Give me something to blow up. Yeah. All right.
He cares about like what he remembers in the past.
Oh, he does care about what he remembers. I see what you're talking about. However, the only reason I would say, wait a minute, a second, is in that making of documentary, I actually thought that Doolittle playing that bottle organ was a Carpenter touch that he brought to it. But Carpenter hated that sequence. Apparently that was one of the things that they added that he hated.
Really?
Yeah. In the making
of
thing.
That's right. They said that in the making of.
Before we move off of Dark Star, we watched it on United Home Video. All right, which also released other films in the United Home Video label. Hustler Squad, Gorgo. The Night Visitor with Liev Ullmann and Max von Sydow.
Yeah.
Another put together hippie science fiction classic, Glenn and Randa, Jim McBride's Glenn and Randa. Eddie Romero's early Beyond
American,
Atlantis.
Early American New Wave.
Charles Band's Dracula's Dog.
Yeah.
Also Eddie Romero's...
I worked for Charlie Band for a while.
Yeah, I know you did. Yeah. Beast of the Yellow Knight and the infamous Manson documentary that we watched a zillion times Video Archives.
God, look at this box.
That lived on
TV. Wow, they went all out on this beautiful box.
Yeah, they did.
Did you use this? Did you watch this?
Oh, of course I did.
I mean, you must have.
Oh, no.
Research.
No, all the girls in the movie all had their own DVDs of this. But they also did movies like... Jack Palance's One Man Jury, Toolbox Murders, The Devil's Reign.
I love The Devil's Reign.
Crater.
We're going to definitely talk about that later.
The Crater Lake Monster and Alistair Sims' Christmas Carol. That was United Home Video, and they were a cool little company.
20 years in space, 1 million light years from Earth. Their job is to clear a path for the colonization of space.
Back home in Malibu. I used to surf a lot, Talby. I used to be a great surfer.
Travel in an infinite universe with mind-melting excitement from beyond the stars. Dark Star. They're not lost in space. They're loose.
Dark Star, with co-hit Life Force, will be playing on August 1st and 2nd on glorious 35mm film at the New Beverly Cinema. 7165 Beverly Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. For further information, go to thenewbev.com. The New Beverly Cinema, always on film.
Okay, and we're back and starting the second half of our show, we are joined by our announcer, Gala Avery.
Hello,
everybody. Say hello to the nice people.
Hello, everyone out there listening.
Podcast land.
Happens to be my daughter.
Yes, daughter and producer, yes.
So Gala, we've been talking about these films. Which of these films did you manage to see?
I actually managed to watch both the movies for this episode. For everyone out there in podcast land, you guys are in luck. Dark Star is available pretty much everywhere. I watched mine out of my dad's DVD collection, and I also have some special secret VHS tapes for you today, Quentin.
Oh, really?
Yes. Uh-huh. Straight from eBay.
Wow, excellent.
And actually, before you begin, I should probably just say, like, while we were doing our stuff and I was, you know, watching all this, I didn't supply Gala really with anything other than you told her the titles that we were doing. And then I just left her to her own devices.
Yeah. So, Gala does not have the access to the Video Archives collection that I do. And via me, Roger does. And so the idea is Gala's just a regular person out there trying to hunt these titles down the way you in Radioland might be hunting these titles down. And she's either successful or she's not.
Yeah.
And luckily this time I was successful.
And this time you were successful.
Yeah, and I haven't really talked to you about this at all, so I'm super excited to hear.
Yeah, we kept this under wraps. Yeah. So, well, today the first movie you guys talked about was Dark Star, which I was shown also when I was like 12 years old by my dad. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, the only thing I remember about Dark Star is the alien sequence. It is alien for children, basically, at that point. And in my brain, when I was rewatching, I was like, where's the alien? That's supposed to be the entire movie in my brain. And I was like, no, it's not the entire film.
When you rewatched the movie?
When I rewatched the movie, yeah. I'm waiting for that alien. And it's only there for like 15, 20, 30 minutes. And I'm thinking, where did it go? Oh, it's dead. But upon rewatching it, I'm able to appreciate especially the dialogue of the movie. Mm-hmm. I find the dialogue so witty, so interesting, so quick, and the visuals are so cool. I know you guys were kind of talking about like, would a younger audience connect mm-hmm. with these visuals? The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. When I'm sitting there, sorry to all the Marvel fans out there, but when I'm sitting there and I'm watching a movie that's just big painted CGI, I get kind of bored.
Yeah, me too.
And when I look and I see Dark Star, man, it has style. It's so cool. You can tell that there is the artist paintbrush on every frame of the movie. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. So I love that. And obviously, my favorite character is Pinback. Dan O'Bannon is amazing in this movie. And I think it's important because you guys were talking about how 2001 has obviously influenced Dark Star. Mm-hmm. But you guys didn't really talk about the influence that Dark Star had on modern comedic science fiction, including Galaxy Quest,
sure,
where Guy is Pinback. He's that guy that's not supposed to be on the ship.
Yeah.
But he
is. Oh, the Sam Rockwell character.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And he's the one guy that knows and cares. He looks at them and says, haven't you guys seen the show before? That's mm-hmm. Pinback. And that's Pinback's
Yeah,
influence.
He's literally like the lowest person on that crew. He doesn't even belong on that crew, Sam Rockwell.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's...
And he knows he's the most disposable.
Yeah, I'm the red shirt. I don't even have a name.
But that's the influence I think that Dark Star has had. And also, you guys brought up something really interesting in your podcast earlier when you said, who is John Carpenter in this movie? Mm-hmm. Well, John Carpenter is not Doolittle. He's the guy up in the bubble. He actually revoices the guy up in the bubble.
Wow.
Which is said
That's Carpenter's voice?
That's Carpenter's voice.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, which I believe is spoken about either in
the audio commentary
on the DVD.
Yeah, that Superfan audio commentary?
The Superfan mm-hmm. audio commentary on the DVD, which is what I watched, is that Carpenter, because the actor had such a thick and heavy accent, mm-hmm. he revoiced the character. So if I was going to say who is Carpenter's self-insert, it would be him.
The stone guy in the bubble.
Yeah. Who's going to fly off and he's like, oh, look at the pretty lights. It's so pretty. I'm one of them. I have to tell you something. It's really important.
I think that is the funniest thing I've heard this year. All right. And again, I remembered everyone laughing in the theater at me being mad at them. All right. But let me tell you this one last thing. It's most important. Don't ever.
I think it's a great moment.
And he's going to tour the galaxy forever,
yeah,
glowing like one of the stars. Maybe that is
I think that's Carpenter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much
thank
for this
guys.
Mid-show report.
And thank you guys so much for having me.
Thank you.
We're just cocaine cowboys. We're just cocaine cowboys. We're just
So now we're going to move on to the next film, Cocaine Cowboys.
Which was a first for me.
Oh, this was definitely a first for myself as well. I've known about this movie. I've never heard it was good. I've never heard anybody say anything good about it. I never heard it was necessarily good. However, in the 80s, it did play from time to time in colleges and the calendars of revival houses, usually with a Warhol title. So it was like you could see it with Andy Warhol's Bad, or it might play with something like 200 Motels.
Sure.
Because of the title. So now I'm going to read the back of the video box to explain the story, which is not going to do a good job of it, by the way. This thriller concerns the exploits of a struggling rock band whose members resort to drug smuggling in order to finance their music career. They end up in deep trouble with mobsters and hired killers. Special appearance by Andy Warhol, rated R for nudity and graphic violence, rated R, 90 minutes.
That says everything you would need to say, except for the fact that you've got Jack Palance in this movie.
Yes, exactly.
Like, so now, why wouldn't they say that in there?
Yeah, well,
they're like, just, why wouldn't you sell Jack Palance?
Well, they should have. So what the basic storyline of the story, normally I'll try not to do this, but on this one, that was insufficient, so I'll do it, is Tom Sullivan plays a guy who's a rock star. He's got a band, which is strangely the name of the band is never mentioned.
I just assume they're the Cocaine Cowboys.
Well, that would be a good name for them, but just, they're, as much as they're talked about in the abstract, the name of the band is never mentioned in the course of the movie.
Yeah.
But their manager is Jack Palance. Their lead singer is Tommy Sullivan, and he's playing himself in the film. And it seems like the band is really, really starting to take off. They're really starting to really make a name for themselves. However, the way that they got started is they started working for these gangster guys, and they became Cocaine Cowboys. And what Cocaine Cowboys are, it's, they're smugglers. They would get a bunch of cocaine in duffel bags or whatever, and they would put them on a small single Cessna kind of
small airplane
that would fly from Colombia or Mexico into America.
First to Florida, then up to New York.
Exactly. And then while they're in the sky, before they land, they will toss the drugs out of the airplane at a certain designated place somewhere out in the woods or in some open area. And then our heroes, the rock group, on horses will pick up the drugs. And that's how the drugs are smuggled into America. And now, but the, now the band is now starting to do really well. So they want to disassociate themselves from the smuggling business and just be a rock band. And Jack Palance wants to help them with that. However, what happens is they're doing one of their cocaine runs, and the guy on the plane sees some cops and he freaks at the airport. So he throws out the drugs. He just gets rid of the drugs, not at the designated place, just throws it out like by the beach somewhere.
Yeah.
And so it's not the Cocaine Cowboys' fault that this happens. Nevertheless, they're on the hook for the drugs.
I don't care where the drugs are. Yeah. I want my money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I want my drugs.
You bought them.
Yeah.
You bought them. So they're under the gun to come up with the money for the drugs or to find the drugs. And so they're, you know, so they spend a lot of the movie scouring on horseback, looking for where the drugs possibly
fell. There's endless magic hour shots of them riding around on horses on these rocky, marshy lands. Yeah. It's really beautiful.
Yeah,
lyrical.
So that's the setup for the plot of the movie. What the movie is really about is two things. One, it's setting up the lead star of the film, Tommy Sullivan, setting him up as a rock star. And there's many scenes of him and his band rehearsing, him and his band playing different songs. Eventually, the Cocaine Cowboy song, which I actually quite like.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And you end up missing it at the end. You want a reprise.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you absolutely want it.
You need a reprise.
You absolutely want it playing in the closing credits. Punctuated with these standalone scenes of Jack Palance. He probably only worked for 3 days, and they did pretty much all of his stuff either within a week or within 3 days. However, he's fantastic in the movie. He's completely doing an Alan Garfield in Skateboard the Movie, where it's most of the movie, you can tell, even though there probably was a script to some degree or another, is pretty much improvised by the actors throughout the film. But it's Jack Palance's improvisations are fantastic.
Yeah.
He makes the film. Every sequence he's in is just funny and it's exciting. He looks amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. He looks fit and handsome.
He's like the Jack Palance who's doing one-armed push-ups stage or something.
He looks terrific. And he looks like he's having a great time.
Yeah.
He looks like he's having a great time, and we're having a great time. Whether or not you respond to this movie is all going to be dependent on whether or not you respond to Tommy Sullivan, the lead. And I think most of the people who don't like the movie, like, it's a horrible band. I can't stand them. I hate the songs. I hate him. It's a fucking drag. Well, I actually disagree. I actually thought he was really groovy. I really got into Tommy Sullivan. He's like a Michael Madsen type of guy, all right? He dresses like a cowboy. He's like a hippie Michael Madsen. He's like a hippie Michael Madsen. Michael Madsen playing a 70s... If Michael Madsen played a 70s era Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Is kind of what Tommy Sullivan is in this
robbing
movie.
Bits of Billy Jack's wardrobe.
Yes, exactly.
Just like
one, I think he's a good singer, and he's really coming on. You know, he takes his shirt off when he sings and going on to be this real sexy rock star, but I think he's got a really powerful voice.
Yeah.
I think he's got a real good lead rock star singer's voice. I like the songs. Naturally, as Uli LaMelle is prone to do, he overuses that one song too many times. Yeah. I would have rather had like at least five different songs. But I actually really like the music in the film. But one of the things about the movie that makes it work, rather than just this weird patchwork of various scenes, this movie actually is one of the more realistic movies about a drug deal gone wrong I think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
One of the things that actually gives this Tommy Sullivan and consequently the movie itself authenticity is it's pretty fucking obvious this is who Tommy Sullivan is. He's obviously a drug smuggler. He's definitely more of a drug smuggler than he actually is a rock star, even though I buy the rock star aspect as far as they're selling it in the course of the movie. But he definitely is a drug dealer. That he definitely is a drug smuggler. That is, and everything about it is authentic.
Yeah.
This is this guy's story. This is why they're making the movie. He does all this. And then in reality, he was one of the most known drug smugglers of his era. He actually didn't do cocaine. He actually smuggled marijuana and hashish, but he did it exactly this way. By renting airplanes and dumping shit out and catching it and having a team on horseback. But again, that's another aspect about the movie that works really well is him and his bandmates look fucking bitching on their horses.
Yeah.
Their hippie cowboy outfits. It's obvious they know how to ride horses. There's a comfortability on the horses. This weird aspect of cocaine cowboys, of this hippie cowboy movie, they capture that. They absolutely capture that. There are moments in showing them in the drug deal and on the horses riding to do the things that they're doing. It suggests a hippie peckinpah.
Sure.
It's one of the things that stops it different from being a bunch of unrelated scenes that, while entertaining initially, wears out its welcome, mm-hmm. which is like a lot of these movies that happens a lot.
Frequently.
A lot of the reviews we'll end up doing on this show was like, okay, it was great. And then there's that last 30 minutes and then it runs out of fucking gas. All right, that's going to be a lot of the movies we're going to say. That's because that's a lot of movies. But Cocaine Cowboys actually does hold together all the way to the end because at the end of the day, it is a crime film. It actually is about a drug deal. To top it all off, the twist at one, you actually, there is a whole reveal. There's a whole third act reveal about what happened to the money that I was not expecting. And it was actually kind of clever.
Yeah.
It was completely
realistic too.
But it was
actually how it would really play out.
Well, the way the drug deal plays out is about as realistic as anything I've ever seen in a movie about this subject.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, oh, that obviously happened to somebody. Yeah.
You know, when we first started watching this film, I didn't know anything. You called me up and you were like, Uli LaMelle. The only thing I knew about him was Fassbender.
Yeah.
Was that he was part of that Fassbender gang. He's part of the
Fassbender New German Cinema in the early 70s.
Yeah, Die Neue Deutsche Film or whatever they called it. Part of the Oberkampf movement.
New queer cinema, all that, yeah.
Yeah, it was actually even more than that because this was an entire generation of filmmakers who had no forefathers in cinema to look up to base their styles on. They didn't have that because Germany had just gone through a period of barbarism.
Yeah, yeah.
And so instead, they looked to the French New Wave. Mm-hmm. And all these Germans looked to what was happening in France, which was light cameras, you know, sensitive film stocks, mm-hmm. grab a camera, go out and catch something. Uli LaMelle comes to New York. He makes Blank Generation and then he makes this film.
Well, before his biggest claim to fame, his biggest claim to legitimacy is after starring in the Fassbender films, he does a movie about a German serial killer that Fassbender produces called The Tenderness of Wolves that I've always heard about, but I've never seen.
It's a notorious.
Yes, it's notorious, but apparently it's pretty good. And it has a bunch of the Fassbender actors in it. Fassbender's even acts in it himself. Yeah. And so that was his claim to legitimacy. Then he came to New York and then he did his underground new wave movie, which was Blank Generation,
which I hadn't seen.
Yeah, I'd heard about it, never seen it. We watched it as a after we saw Cocaine Cowboys, we watched it as a research movie,
which is interesting because the two movies there's he's reusing.
Well, there's a symbiotic relationship between the two, even though I don't like Blank Generation at all.
Exactly, but ideas are thought out in Blank Generation that would later be fulfilled.
I agree. No,
Cocaine Cowboys.
No, that's very well said.
Well, and that was kind of the CSI component of watching Cocaine Cowboys is like the movie is composed of like it begins with this interview scene where Andy Warhol is interviewing Tom and you immediately can tell either this guy is an amazing actor or he's really recounting things that are real, that really happened. Oh, that guy must be a real drug dealer. I started just studying it and saying, okay, it's coverage. It's two cameras. He's got one in a dolly. He's got another one where he's catching close-ups of people who's just moving back and forth and catching close-ups. And then I noticed there's all these rehearsal sequences where he and his band are rehearsing. And it's the same setups.
They rented Andy Warhol's house in Montauk and shot the film there. And Andy Warhol is actually in the movie as Andy Warhol kind of throughout it. And actually, and I liked him in it. I actually thought he was a neat element to it.
He's kind of fantastic. He's super naturalistic.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's actually asking.
And yeah, you can tell he actually has a fondness for Tommy Sullivan.
Yeah. And then, and there's that other interview scene where they're looking at pictures.
Yeah.
And Tommy Sullivan's talking about his hand.
Yeah.
And,
well, one of the things about the film, which I have to say, I didn't notice it at first. All right. Until it came up. But he wears this really gorgeous white leather glove throughout the movie. He ends up talking about why he wears the glove. And it turns out, and again, you realize that this is actually true. You realize that he was on an airplane, probably doing a drug deal, and the plane crashed. And he was terribly burnt, and his hand
engulfed in flames.
His hand was burnt to a nub.
Yeah, it's just bone.
Yeah, and so now he wears this glove wherever
to hide the hideous claw.
Wherever he goes. Okay.
Now, in the Andy Warhol diaries, in the entry dated January 9th, 1978, set in Halston's townhouse, it reads, "Then Peter Beard came in with a guy who had a beautiful glove and a bottle of Coke in the other hand. And then later, he showed us the hand, which was a stump. It looked like in the movies when they showed the fiend to school. He lost it in a plane crash, his third plane crash, a DC-10 that he owns. He passed the bottle of Coke around." And in the book, The Last Party, it reveals that that man was Tom Sullivan, and he was from Tampa, Florida. Beard, a photographer and socialite who had been introduced to him by the tennis player, Sullivan looked like a charming rube and a former football player, which he was. What with his leather clothes, his Western hat, he also looked like a country rocker in a 60s band. Sullivan, in brief, might have seemed like an unlikely addition to the inner core of the club, except that he always seemed to have amazing quantities of both drugs and money, so the core swiftly enfolded Sullivan into their embrace. So two interesting quotes on Sullivan, both from the Andy Warhol diaries and from The Last Party. So my thoughts, ultimately, on Cocaine Cowboys, I really dug it.
I really dug it. I was surprised. I expected it to be interesting, but I expected it to run out of gas. To me, it didn't run out of gas. It's the one that I was tempted to look at again, but I didn't want to because I didn't want to put it under that much of a microscope. I was afraid I wouldn't like it if I watched it again. I'm not sold on Uli Lamel as a filmmaker, but I think he pulled off something with Cocaine Cowboys. And one of the things that I really appreciated about the movie is I think this film captures the aesthetic that Dennis Hopper as a filmmaker was always trying to capture and never quite captured. Now, I mean, you can make a case that he captured it in Easy Rider, and you'd be right. However, like, you know, he had originally had a 4-hour cut of Easy Rider. This is cut down to make the film. But if these wild movies that Dennis Hopper had in his head in the first half of the 70s, if he had actually been able to make them and they had actually been coherent, that could actually carried off like a real commercially released movie, they would have been like Cocaine Cowboys.
Yeah.
I think the style that he was after, if he had ever found it.
Yeah.
I'm making more of a case about Tommy Sullivan. I was prepared to make more of a case about Uli Lamel until I saw Black Generation.
What do you think about his relationship with Fassbender? Because it's not like he works with Fassbender again. He's he and Fassbender are close. He's younger than Fassbender. Mm-hmm. And like Fassbender is part of the, like that whole Oberkampf manifesto group. Mm-hmm. He's like at the front of the new German cinema with Wim Wenders and Herzog and those guys. Louis Lamel is like not second generation, but clearly like his, I don't want to say protege, but like his.
Well, it would appear that, he was part of the Fassbender camp, and that was for sure in Germany. Then he moved to New York and then became part of the Andy Warhol camp.
Yeah.
Well, he traded one camp for another.
And the question is, why leave that camp? Because in Germany at that time, unless the money was also being used for Blank Generation, at that time in Germany, they had formed their own system because the German industry was kind of broken. And so these guys were like, they formed their own distribution entity.
Why would he go to New York to make shitty exploitation movies? That I do not know. When it seems like he has a good situation making gonzo art movies, I do not have an answer for that.
There it is. The whole thing is watching it. Like, I'm always thinking about production, economy of production. Mm-hmm. How do you get the most for less? I mean, we've just come off of a $40,000 film. This movie was for sure more than that. Mm-hmm. This is probably 400, 300, 400,000.
I've heard up to a million.
Really?
I've heard in some of
that's
the-
That's what they tell you.
And some of the reports.
That's what the producers say.
And some of the reports I've heard up to a million. And I find that hard to believe, but there is a quality of camera work. There is a quality of film. There is a quality to it that,
that is possible because they may have been searching for moments and that takes time.
Yeah.
And you can definitely feel that someone was taking time to do things. However, so much of it is, okay, we've got this bed, which is the narration with Andy Warhol. We've got these beds of
music sequences.
Music sequences where we're rehearsing that are endless. It seems like it goes on and on and on. And the movie is designed as a showcase for all of that.
Yeah.
And
then we have our Jack Palance scenes.
And then we've got, your 4 days with Jack Palance where you jam him in and you somehow get him high, probably. That's probably why he's so fucking on fire in the movie is he's on cocaine. He must be, because he's just outstanding.
He's
in the
outstanding.
Film. And you're right. He is doing the Alan Garfield thing where he has a very, very loose script written by a German, probably.
Yeah.
He's got a loose script and he's got to make
it
his own.
He's there to riff and make something out of nothing. And he does.
Oh, he brings it all.
He's awesome. And he's amazing.
And so, and then
you've
got enjoyable. And then you've got these kind of long, highly lyrical shots around Montauk, just shooting them riding around on their horses through the marshes, searching for the cocaine. And actually, I mean,
and again, you don't expect the drug story to start getting into the minutiae of it in the second half, and it does.
Yeah.
And then there is a turn.
Well, like the plot,
there's actually a plot that turns plot in a way you don't expect.
I'm saying it's like 30% plot, 70% feeling.
Yes.
There's all this feeling going on, and then you start realizing this is all based on him actually talking to Andy Warhol, who's like in those days, everybody loves an outlaw. And he's there, in New York, and they're among all the glam people, and all the glam people want to hang out with an outlaw. And he's telling them all these stories, and it's sort of like Uli Lamel's hanging out in that scene, and he's just done Blank Generation. It just makes sense.
So here's the, so I've finished the film. I'm like, well, who the fuck is this Tommy Sullivan guy? Well, I go and find out. Okay, so I do a lot of research now. Also, if you're trying to go do research on Tommy Sullivan, you're going to get screwed up a little bit on the internet because there's that dorky blind singer guy, Tom Sullivan, all right, from the 70s that's out there. I hated. He was on every talk show when I was a kid. I fucking hated that guy. And finding out who Tommy Sullivan is, he's actually talked about quite a bit. He's quite a character in the book, The Last Party, which is the book about Studio 54, that time by Anthony Hayden Guest. He's also mentioned quite a bit in the Warhol diaries. He's a main character in a couple of Albert Goldman articles. And he's Tommy Sullivan is mentioned in Margaret Trudeau's autobiography, which will become clear later when I tell the Tommy Sullivan story. So basically what happened with Tommy Sullivan is around 77, he hits New York in The Last Party. The first mention of Tommy Sullivan is quoted as a gangly Floridian with blue eyes, pink skin, and longish fair hair. That's how he's described. He's not just a successful drug smuggler. He's one of the most known legendary drug smugglers of his time, because he's the one who kind of came up with the whole concept of putting them in mini airplanes and dropping them. In fact, it's even quoted as saying that the talk about Tommy Sullivan is before Tommy Sullivan, drug smuggling was done on wheels. Tommy's the one that gave it wings. And all of a sudden, this cowboy hippie shows up in New York City with $2 million in cash, and he wants to have a good time. So where does he go? Studio 54. And yeah, he's got drugs. He's got unlimited cash. And apparently, according to in the last party, according to one of the bartenders, he was the best tipper at Studio 54. He would go to Studio 54. He would ask for Jack Daniels. He'd want the Jack Daniels poured right up to the rim. And then when they did that, he'd put $100. He paid for every drink he ever bought at Studio 54 with $100, no matter what it cost. And so from that point on, that bartender made sure that he always took care of Tommy Sullivan. So, he becomes a scenester there. And while being a scenester, he becomes friendly with the Warhol mob that's hanging out at Studio 54. At the same time all this is happening, Margaret Trudeau has left her husband, the Prime Minister of Canada, Pierre Trudeau. And she's in New York. And she's there to have a good time.
Yeah, she's just there to party.
She's there to party. Honestly. And so by hanging out with Andy Warhol, she meets Tommy Sullivan. And they have an affair. And there's even a picture of them dancing together in the last party book. And you can imagine how terrible this was for Pierre Trudeau while he's the prime minister.
Yeah, he's a standing prime minister.
Not only is his wife in New York catting around in public where paparazzi is filming her and everybody knows it. The last person as you would want your wife to have an affair with is this skeezy drug dealer who thinks he's a cowboy Michael Madsen. The last guy you want with your wife. Well, but that's what time it is.
But they actually make a really good couple because she's kind of elegant and chic and he's kind of grimy. And
it's grimy. Yeah, yeah, no, like, no, exactly.
Like, they actually look really good together.
And then there's another Warhol gal, Catherine Guinness. He's having an affair with her, but also hanging around with Warhol and becoming part of Warhol's little crew. You know, he's hanging out with people like Isabella Rossellini, Bianca Jagger, Klaus von Bülow. You know, he's hanging out with all of them. And, you know, and one of those
Klaus
people.
Klaus von Bülow, all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I guess, yeah. Probably throwing Truman Capote in there, or Liz Taylor,
okay, now it's all of them.
Yeah. But also Uli Lamel is one of them. So he now knows Uli Lamel a little bit, and he goes and visits the set, probably, of Blank Generation. Mm-hmm. So he's watching Blank Generation being made, and he's watching them shoot Richard Hell and orchestrate everything around that, and Warhol's in that, and Sullivan's sitting there watching this thing. Hey, this would be pretty fucking cool. I kind of like this. And he kind of wants to be a singer, you know, and he's seeing the treatment that Richard Hell's getting. So he goes up to Uli Lamel and says, so look, if I could get the money, I'd like to do, if I can get the money, if I can get a name actor to agree to be in the film, would you be interested in doing a movie starring me? It'd be, and you could do and be a similar thing, what you're doing with Richard Hell. I get to sing, I get to do this. And I'll also tell my drug story. Will you direct the movie? And Lamel goes, yeah, sure. Fuck yeah. Of course I'll do it. So they write the film. Now, at the same time, there's two other guys that Sullivan meets at this time, a guy named Tom Forshade and Lech Kowalski. Now, they want to get into the movie making business. So basically, with Tommy's drug money, he grubstakes them to get them going. And they end up making two movies. The first movie is the famous punk rock documentary DOA.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the movie that has the big Sid and Nancy interview in it. And then the second movie is Cocaine Cowboys. Now, I heard that Tommy Sullivan grubstaked the movie. Also, doing other research, I think he paid for the whole goddamn movie himself. I think when it comes to Cocaine Cowboys, he paid for the whole damn movie.
It's a vanity project. If we're really talking, it's a vanity project.
Oh, it's absolutely a
film of caprice. I mean,
and then I've heard different figures as far as like the budget of it is concerned, but I've even heard it being referred to as $1 million. Mm-hmm. That is the Tommy Sullivan story. He makes Cocaine Cowboys. I couldn't find that if it ever got a theatrical release in Los Angeles, during its initial theatrical run. It did play New York, and it got a bad review in the New York Times. And I think after that, that's when it started falling into the repertory house circuit and the college circuit and the cult midnight.
The late night circuit.
Yeah. Midnight circuit. Tommy later, his affair blew up with Margaret Trudeau. She actually dumped him for Jack Nicholson for a while. He was trying to get out of the drug business. I heard at some point some gangsters showed up in New York and he gave them $1 million of his dollars in order to keep from getting killed. He had a situation similar to what happened in the movie, except it didn't happen with an airplane. It happened with a fishing boat.
Mm.
There is no band. They put together the band themselves, all right, for the film. It didn't do for him what he wanted. He wasn't able to get a recording contract out of it. He did later marry, I believe she was the Miss Holland or something. Mm-hmm. All right. And then he died in 81. I think he was around 26. How he died, it's not sure. Albert Goldman, the way Albert Goldman talks, you could believe that he was murdered by the gangsters. Mm-hmm. However, since it's not recorded in the obituary exactly how he died, it suggests that he either died of either an overdose or he died of pneumonia or complications due to his drug use. That's the best.
It sounds like HIV, to be honest.
Well,
we're talking about that time period. So
yeah, but one of Warhol's diaries, he suggests that Tommy died due to the needle, and one of his associates, Kowalski, suggests that he died due to pneumonia.
Well, both can be true. Yes. And, the needle can give you pneumonia. Yeah.
And that is the Tommy Sullivan story. So we watch Cocaine Cowboys on the New Pacific Pictures video label, which is a fly-by-night video label that I was looking up. I found one other film in the collection that I have. It's a South African slave drama called Slavers with Trevor Howard, Ray Milland, Cameron Mitchell, and Brett Eklund. And actually, I've always wanted to see this movie. I remember when it came out. It came out in the lower half of a double feature. But I want to check. Well, we'll check it out one of these days. That's the only New Pacific Pictures other film that I found in the collection. Not to say we don't have others, but they specialized, like Cocaine Cowboys, in a bunch of either public domain movies or movies that kind of fell into a never land that a bunch of other outfits released. So they also released Ride in the Whirlwind, Monty Hellman's Western, Woody Strode Western, The Gatling Gun, the Italian Women in Prison movie, The Big Bust Out, and the horror title Three on a Meat Hook. Those are some of the other New Pacific Pictures films. However, I will give New Pacific Pictures a shout out. While the box is completely anonymous, as no pictures of the actors on it, just a picture of the Roxy, all right, a weird night vision picture of the Roxy on Hollywood Boulevard, as if that has anything to do with...
Yeah, which makes absolutely no sense.
It has nothing to do with the movie. No pictures of Jack Palance, no pictures of anything, especially for a movie that actually has a really great one sheet. But you know what? The film is obviously made in SP. It has that nice, heavy kind of SP kind of heft to it. It was a really surprisingly good transfer from what looked like a very good 35mm print.
Yeah.
I mean, a really unblemished 35mm print.
It was a very nice looking.
But enjoyably not mint either, all right? Yeah. It had seen a projector or two in its day, but with very little wear and tear. So
it's funny. This movie is such.
If the rest of the new Pacific Pictures transfers are as good as Cocaine Cowboy, then way to go, company.
This movie is such an East Coast Atlantic film that it's funny that it's released here by New Pacific and they've got a thing on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like they've Pacificized a very East Coast movie.
Yeah, it's such a New York rock scene movie. Montauk, no less.
Quentin, here you go. Here's my copy, my VHS copy.
From Video Gems.
Video Gems! I did the show on the Video Gems. I can't wait for us to have our first Video Gems tape on here.
But here's my copy of Cocaine
Cowboys.
That's
a really good box. That's
fucking badass, man.
Okay, did this box come out after or before?
What do you mean after or before?
Of this box.
Well, I'm sure this one probably came out a little later. Yeah, because it first came out on media. So it came out in media, and so then eventually, I guess, Video Gems got it. And then any fly-by-night company did get a print. <Yeah. laughs>
But I think it has a really cool opening sequence, like you guys said, which is a little bit marred by it being repeated
again and again.
Blank Generation again and again. Quentin, it's interesting that you mentioned that it would play with Heat, especially because Elliot Goldenthal did the soundtrack for this, and he also did the soundtrack for Heat.
Oh, okay, that makes
sense,
yeah.
So it was like an interesting, he also did an Interview with the Vampire and Pet Sematary.
I think it's just on the, in Revival Houses and college campuses, it was just an easy one. They probably had a few copies laying around the film exchange house. So it was very easy to pair with a Warhol-centric movie. Actually, a movie that I got paired with a lot was that Edie Sedgwick documentary, Chow Manhattan.
Yeah, Chow Manhattan.
Yes. That's where it played a lot with Bad and Chow Manhattan.
We have that here in somewhere, don't we?
Yeah. Uh-huh. We have Chow Manhattan.
And one thing I felt that you guys didn't really touch upon in your discussion of Cocaine Cowboys was the strange, I'm going to just say, fetishistic homoeroticness of the film. And I don't know if either of you picked up on it.
I don't think I did. We've seen so many homoerotic movies.
We were cuddling while watching it. So.
Cocaine Cowboys didn't break a surface compared to all this shit we've been watching lately.
I think it's really, really fascinating because the drug dealers, their nicknames for each other are Daddy-O and Baby. Mm-hmm. Just call me Baby.
Yeah.
And it's like this interesting, strange.
That's one of my favorite lines of the whole thing is the drug dealer tells Jack Fallon, just call me Baby. Well, okay, if you insist. Baby.
And beyond that, the funniest scene for me in the movie is the baby powder sex scene.
Mm-hmm.
When the assistant houseboy and the maid are kind of romping around. Mm-hmm. And she's like, what do you want me to do? And he's like, get the baby powder.
And the maid is Susanna Love. That's Uli Lamell's wife.
Yeah, Uli Lamell's wife.
But
who's in almost all of his movies, not all of his movies.
For a while.
That
scene just made no sense to me whatsoever. It was like a strange fetishistic thing that just kind of came out of nowhere. Really fun and interesting, but...
You heard my fascination for Tommy Sullivan. What was your take on Tommy Sullivan?
You know, I liked the music in the movie, but I wasn't so captivated by him.
Yeah.
I actually enjoyed the music in this movie more than Blank Generation. But I wasn't so captivated by his character and his story. I think the scene when he's on the horse at the very end and he kind of like is calling the guy out, but he's wrong. That's the most interesting moment that he has for me.
Yeah.
But other than that, I kind of was more interested actually in like the houseboy assistant and the maid.
Oh, you were. Okay.
I was more. And also.
Well, then you're in luck because they end up taking over the third act.
Yeah, exactly. And also I liked the Asian chef who I felt was a little underutilized.
I agree about that. Yeah, he was a cool character.
Yeah. And also, it's definitely, this movie is way more interesting knowing the backstory that Quentin and Roger just talked about. When I did not know this backstory, it was a little bit of a snooze fest for me. Mm-hmm. But hearing that this is like an actual, based on true events, based on someone's actual life, that they did these things, that makes me go, huh, I wish I would have paid a little bit more attention to those aspects of the movie.
Okay.
So I think this movie is definitely something that could have a rewatch from me.
Yeah, you would revisit it.
And reappreciate it.
And you watched a couple of our... background films, as far as Uli Lamell.
Yes, and actually, I was aware of Uli Lamell because Uli Lamell has the 9th lowest rated movie on Letterboxd. And so I was aware of Uli Lamell.
Which one?
It's one of his newer movies. I always mix up either it's Daniel the Magician or Daniel the Wizard.
I think it's Daniel the Magician.
I think it's Daniel the Magician, but apparently that movie is notorious, and people hate Uli Lamell.
Hate him.
But they hate him, and I was like, God, this guy, he must be terrible. And then I watched Cooking Cowboys, I'm like, okay, he's not that bad. Mm-hmm. Then I watched The Boogeyman. I'm like, okay, I really like The Boogeyman. Mm-hmm. I know that might not be the case in the whole room right now, but I really like The Boogeyman. I thought it had style, mm-hmm. and I thought it was fun.
Well, here's the deal about The Boogeyman is I didn't see it when it came out. I remember when it came out. I think it was actually seeing John Carradine so high in the credits. I was like, well, that's never a good sign, even though I like John Carradine. Actually, he's one of my more favorite things in the movie, especially the fact that he has a real role. He's serious in the film. It's actually nice for him to commit to playing a real role in a movie, not just a goofy cameo.
All they're able to do is put him in a chair, it's always the same chair.
But he's serious, though. He's giving a serious performance. He's playing a serious character that has something to do with the movie. He's not being paraded as a grotesquerie. I didn't see it. Then Uli Lamo became infamous. And so I was like, wow, I don't want to see it. Then I ended up picking up a print, a 35mm print of Boogeyman 4 or 5 years ago. And when I picked up the print, I go, well, you know, I got a print now. Might as well give it a watch. And I watched it and I was like, oh, that wasn't bad. That was actually pretty good. Now, when we watched it together again, it was far lesser the second time around for me. You know, I even thought it kicked the evening in the nuts a little bit.
my problem with the film is that it didn't follow its own rules. It didn't follow any rules. Mm-hmm. Like usually if there's like a kind of horror phenomenon type thing, there's some kind of rules to follow. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't. It's just everything.
I will give this. The first 15 minutes made me think it was going to be a better movie because the first 15 minutes is the stuff that's the most like Halloween.
Oh, yeah. Completely.
And it actually follows pretty good Halloween. And there's even an interesting aspect to it that it's a devil possession movie, but it's built around these random killings. So it has the structure of a slasher film, even though it's a devil possession movie.
Yeah.
I think I was more in the same boat you were in when I watched the print. It didn't hold up a second time for me.
You know, I think those last like 15, 20 minutes of it, though, are really super cool. And the thing I have to say about The Boogeyman, I mean, Roger might agree with me on this. I think, okay, so for me, it's like the slasher meets The Exorcist.
Yeah.
I think it has some really cool killing scenes that you don't see. You see a lot of slasher movies where it's just like slasher.
Yeah, yeah.
But like this, for example, Boogeyman had what I call the knife kiss scene in the car, when it's like one dies and the knife goes through and then the other one moves forward to kiss and they're stuck in that eternal kiss.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, that's so cool. Cause their friends are just like, oh God, these two, they're always making out, like get out of here. Like, ah.
Yeah.
But I like that.
I like the scissor kill.
The scissor kill's cool. The knife kiss kill.
Listen,
cool.
That mirror in the eye bit, which was part of the commercial when it originally played part of the trailer when it was on TV, it was that, and that was what got me excited when the movie first came out, was that like that crazy mirror.
The whole eye concept of a mirror possessed, even though it actually becomes interesting who's possessing the mirror, that's interesting. But even the whole idea of a mirror possessed and pieces break up, okay. I think that stopped me from seeing it when it first came out in the first thing. That sounds bad.
Yeah. It's
and it's actually not as bad as it sounds. And I will say one thing about Boogeyman is one of my favorite critics that me and Roger I've introduced to Roger is a critic from the late 70s, early 80s named Jim Shelton, who used to write for the Porno Rag, the Hollywood Press. The only film we've mentioned that he actually did a review for is The Boogeyman. And so I'm going to read not his review, but his reviews are usually consist of the plot line of the movie. So there's a little bit of a opinion at the beginning and a little bit of opinion at the end. So so this is from the November 28, 1980 edition of Hollywood Press. Jim Shelton's review for The Boogeyman. The Boogeyman has exorcist-like possession and music and titles, an Amityville-looking house.
Yeah, absolutely. Amityville, right?
Yes. Uh-huh, and other regurgitated cliches in a first American film from German semi-underground Uli Lamel. So he describes the plot line, then he ends. The obviously surreal duelings of Lamel, who also wrote and produced, are not enhanced by diluted lensing, mediocre acting, and the mirthful appearance by John Carradine in a straight role as a shrink. Don't pick this boogie. D-.
For anyone that's interested in Boogeyman, it's available on VHS, DVD, and Amazon to rent. And you guys are in luck because Cocaine Cowboys is available for free on YouTube.
Well, I think that wraps it up for our very first episode of the Video Archives podcast. I want to thank my co-host, Roger Avery. I want to thank the lovely Gala Avery, our researcher, reporter on the beat, and announcer.
Hey, Quentin, I'm so happy to be back at Video Archives. Thanks for this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Be kind, rewind. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.
Dream of times and spaces I left far behind.
The Video Archives podcast is hosted by Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery and produced by Josh Richman and Gala Avery. Our engineer is Devin Torrey Bryant, and our executive producers are Colin Anderson and Natalie Muella. This episode featured additional production by Raven Goldston. Find out more about the show by heading to videoarchivespodcast.com.
But they seem so much kinder.